essentially, we think we probably flooded the float and sank it that way, but we're not sure yet.
The city of Skagway has a theory on why the town's ferry dock sank. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an early spring means an early flood watch program on the state's largest rivers.
Generally, we do launch our river watch program a little bit later in the year. There's been higher than normal temperatures in the interior.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The community of Skagway in northern southeast remains cut off from ferry service as the state works to figure out why the dock sank late last week. From member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
The State Department of Transportation contracted with Western Marine Construction to begin salvaging and repairing the state-owned Skagway ferry dock. The company moved two barges to the town over the weekend and plan on trying to refloat the dock on Tuesday or Wednesday. However, the dock will likely need repairs before it can start hosting Alaska Marine Highway ferries again, according to State DOT spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow.
You know, we'll know a lot more once we get the dock floated again and be able to assess the damage, and we'll be able to devise a plan from there.
Why the dock sank is still unknown, although Skagway Mayor Mark Schaefer says there is a working theory having to do with the potable water supply to the dock. The system consists of a 3-inch pipe running from the terminal to the dock and partway underneath, making it easy for state ferries to resupply with water. Schaefer says the entire Skagway community averages 300,000 gallons of water from the municipal supply in a 24-hour period. But between Wednesday evening and Thursday morning, when the ferry dock sank, Schaefer said the city registered 800,000 gallons of water use.
So, essentially, We think we probably flooded the float and sank it that way, but we're not sure yet. We know we used a whole bunch of water, and it's not bubbling up in the street somewhere. That's a significant amount of water.
The dock is a 120 by 160 foot platform that sits on 24 individual concrete chambers that float the structure. Mayor Schaefer compares the floating mechanism to a concrete ice cube tray. The potable water line runs through several of those chambers, hence the theory about flooding the compartments, he said. Woodrow says the state is aware of the theory Schaefer describes, but the state is not yet ready to say that is the official cause of the dock sinking.
We're investigating all theories and possibilities at this point.
The state was able to bypass a bidding process for the dock salvage and established a sole source contract with Western Marine because of the urgency of the situation, Woodrow says. The cost of the operation and repairs is not yet known. The state has suspended ferry service to the town until at least May 9th. Woodrow says none of the Skagway cruise ship docks or the small boat harbor are able to accommodate state ferries and vehicle and passenger traffic. Alaska Seaplanes and Air Excursions have added flights to Skagway while ferry service is suspended. Reporting from Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
As snow melts, wildfire is becoming a threat. Red flag warnings are in effect for areas of South Central and Interior Alaska, including Fairbanks, Delta Junction, and Tokoe. Receding snow has exposed grasses and other dead vegetation, and National Weather Service meteorologist John Lingus says persistent high pressure is allowing them to dry out quickly.
It's really inhibited any substantial moisture from getting into it. So we get a little bit of cloud in, but the dry conditions near the surface persist, and as each day goes on, they just get a little drier, and that's prompted relative humidities at or around 15% here over the last couple of afternoons, and we expect the same today.
Lincoln says a weak system is expected to provide some relief for the Fairbanks area tomorrow, with a chance of a little rain or even snow at higher elevations before things warm up and dry out again later in the week.
High pressure over the Alaska Peninsula now is going to get shoved northward into the interior, and it's going to grow and get stronger. So we are looking for even warmer temperatures at the end of the week, and then a return also to dry conditions.
Teams are heading out to keep an eye on breakup conditions along Alaska's largest river systems. The National Weather Service is predicting below average flooding this year, but the state wants villages to be ready just in case. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Even though flooding caused by this spring's breakup should be less severe than normal, the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zedek says interior communities could still see some flooding.
Generally, when we see the below average years and we do experience flooding, it's one community. It's not a series of communities like we saw last year with the flooding all along the Yukon River.
Galena was devastated last year after an ice jam caused a massive flood, keeping much of the town underwater for days and forcing most residents to evacuate. Once the waters receded, residents returned to largely unsalvageable homes and other problems from lack of power to spoiled food. The village of Circle and several other interior communities were also hit by flooding. Zedek says the First River Watch Team has already been deployed to the upper Yukon River and is stationed in Circle Hot Springs.
Generally, we do launch our River Watch program a little bit later in the year. There's been higher than normal temperatures in the interior, and there's a lot of reports of ice moving early in the sloughs and small tributaries that feed into the major rivers.
Each river watch team consists of three people: a local pilot, a National Weather Service River Forecast Center hydrologist, and a Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management emergency manager. Zedek says each team monitors a particular section of the river, tracking the breakup process.
For the most part, it is aerial observations. The River Forecast Center takes those aerial observations, the past models, and also other observations that have been made along the river system where people just provide their own feedback, put that all together and make their flood potential forecasts. And if there's any issues, they can issue their flood warnings and advisories.
If the teams do spot something that might be troubling for nearby communities, the emergency manager will land and consult with local residents and coordinate with the state emergency office. Five River Watch teams will be deployed, three to the Yukon River and two to the Kuskokwim River. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For more information on flood preparedness, go to alaskapublic.org. Earlier this month, about a dozen snow machines drifted off into the Bering Sea near the village of Quinguilianoc when a large chunk of ice broke off and drifted out. From member station KYUK, Charles Enoch reports.
It was an otherwise normal day of seal hunting when about 12 hunters were alerted their snow machines were adrift roughly 3 miles from shore with an ice floe that had broken off. Quinguilianoc resident Johnny Andrew Jr. was one of those hunters.
Those who went home ahead of us spotted them. We called them on the VHFs to ask if they got home. Then we hurried home, once alerted that the snow machines were 3 miles from shore. Then we brought them back to shore by boat.
Village rescuers pulled one snow machine out of the salt water. Another machine had already disappeared under the ice. Andrew says both machines were attached to sleds that dragged the snow machines off the ice when the ice was drifting in the currents. Andrew speculates the reason for the incident was caused by increased wave activity causing the ice to break off. Seal hunting in the spring is known for its many hazards, the most significant considered the unpredictable nature of the sea and wavy conditions even in calm weather. Conditions that can get the best of even the most experienced of hunters, as Quinguilianoc Elder Roland Phillip explains.
Since I've been hunting and traveling as a boy, I was repeatedly told that in the spring the sea is wavy even when there's no wind, breaking the ice even though it's thick. The sea doesn't tell you what it's going to do even on a good day. There are many dangers. Even the most experienced hunters run into hardships from time to time. We talk about it, but you can't completely avoid hardships. That's the way it's always been.
Since then, the Quinguilianoc River has broken up, giving hunters a safer, more direct approach to seal hunting. In Bethel, this is Charles Enoch.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, investigating whale contaminant levels from an unusual source.
We just received a bowhead earplug this last summer. It's actually about 2 feet long and weighs about 2 pounds.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, offering 3D mammography since January 2014, technology that helps their radiologists detect breast cancer. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A biologist from Baylor University in Texas has discovered a unique way to determine changes in hormone and contaminant levels in baleen whales through their earwax. Stephen Trumbull is a whale biologist who studied at UAF. He says museums have collected these earwax plugs for a century, and the Smithsonian alone has more than 500. They are commonly used to determine a whale's age, like tree rings. But 3 years ago, an environmental chemist suggested to Trumbull the wax plugs were also like sediment cores. It was a moment of insight.
People have been looking at these things for 100 years, right? And we just happen to look at it a different way. And without, you know, an environmental chemist standing there saying, wow, this is like a sediment core, I would have looked at it just like every other biologist would have looked at it. So, you know, it's an aging tool. So it was a very serendipitous. We had this neat little collaborative moment.
Sort of like tree rings?
Exactly like tree rings. Yeah, absolutely.
Describe what they look like and how big they are. What does this plug look like?
The blue whale earplug was probably 25 centimeters, which is a good foot long. Weighed a few hundred grams. This particular earplug is very kind of firm, looked like a stick. Now, we just received a bowhead earplug this last summer that's actually about 2 feet long and weighs about 2 pounds. So it's, and, you know, as you can guess, just a big glob of wax. All in all, it's not very attractive, but.
And I can't imagine what it must smell like.
You really can't imagine. It's pretty horrendous, but you know, put a little Vaseline under the nose, you're good to go.
What are you learning from these wax earplugs?
We can reconstruct kind of a chemical profile for the life of the animal, and that's very significant in two ways. We can see when chemicals sort of came online or came on board the animal, whether or not it was transferred during lactation, whether they picked it up from the environment. And then, not only that, we can also see the response of the animal. What's their hormone or their stress profile look like? So if they're exposed to something in the natural environment, what is their response? Is their stress level increase? Doesn't it change? We can see when they've matured based on various developmental hormones. More significantly, and we think, seeing, especially from a contaminant perspective, and we can actually tell when did PDEs come into the environment. Is DDT still relevant in the environment? And we can actually kind of track that through these earplugs.
How do you think this could apply in Alaska? The bowhead population appears to be stable. It's growing every year. But the Cook Inlet beluga is a population of concern and also has a lot of mystery kind of surrounding what is going on with that population, why they don't seem to be recovering. Do you think that this research can maybe help with Cook Inlet beluga?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, at this point, we think that the earplugs are only in baleen whales. They're not in the smaller toothed whales or dolphins or porpoises and things like that. Bowheads, however, bowheads are a great model. One, very long-lived, 150 years, some estimates. And so if we have some sort of a record going back 100 years of contaminants, it's priceless data. It really is. Not only that, these are subsistence hunted. So there's always an issue with, you know, what are we taking into our bodies? And so we can see not only when contaminants came on board to this animal, but what contaminants. Are there petroleum hydrocarbons? Are there, you know, what things are showing up in the Arctic that, matter of fact, in the 1969 sample from a gray whale that we worked up, we did not find any flame retardants. And in the 2007 sample, we did. Now, you can do this with blubber samples. You can take a blubber sample and say, well, yes, we get the signal for flame retardants. But now we can tell when it came on board. You know, was it in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s? And this would give, you know, researchers a better tool to understand how long people have been exposed to these chemicals.
Stephen Trumbull is an associate professor of biology at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He was recently in Anchorage discussing his research. Bethel's Megan Leary is the 2014 first runner-up of the Miss Indian World competition, which concluded Saturday night at the Gathering of Nations in Albuquerque, New Mexico. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The contest brings together young indigenous culture bearers from all across North America. Arriving at the Bethel Airport Sunday night to cheers from family and friends, Leary says it was them who made it possible for her to compete.
Knowing that they were here at home watching me and I was like a role model for them and I was the leader for them, and that was a lot of, when I went there I was saying, you know, win or lose, I came here to represent people back home, and that's what I did, just thinking of them.
23-year-old Leary is Yupik and Athabascan. She grew up in Kalskeg and Napaimute and graduated from Bethel Regional High School. She was Miss Chemai in 2013. She went on to become Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or Miss WIO. At the Miss Indian World competition, Leary won the contests for best speech and best talent for traditional skin sewing. There was also a personal interview with judges and an impromptu public speaking competition.
It was a funny question. My question was, describe traditional foods of your tribe. So I explained aguduk and stinkeds and blackfish, stuff like that, and people were kind of grossed out by the things that we eat.
For a traditional talent presentation, Leary showed off traditional skin sewing, which was done with help from people all along the river. She was also judged on a dance performance in front of thousands of people.
You know, it made you so proud of who you were and what you were representing, because you weren't going down there as yourself, you were going down there as everybody that, you know, in your family, everybody in the Kuskokwim, everybody in the state of Alaska, because I was representing my title, Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics, and I'm an ambassador of all Alaska Native people of the state, and I went down there for everybody and all my ancestors.
21-year-old Taylor Thomas from the Shoshone-Bannock tribe in Idaho was crowned the 2014 Miss Indian World. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
It's only April, and already a dozen brush fires have erupted in the Matanuska-Susitna area. State foresters are looking ahead to a busy fire season, and as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, fire suppression trainees are brushing up on essential skills, including driving the fire truck.
The huge parking lot outside the State Division of Forestry building in Palmer was alight with bright orange traffic cones last week as the Alaska Engine Academy drilled trainees in the art of driving a fully loaded water truck at top speed backwards through a figure-eight course. The academy puts drivers through their paces in speed and agility tests, forward and in reverse, in tightly defined lanes.
It's really easy to flip your front end out and smack those cones.
Kenai trainee Tyler Johnson awaits his driving trials in the big Type 4 water truck.
I haven't done it outside of training, though. Yeah, that would be something else. That's why we got us here. So we train how to drive this thing so we don't mess it up on the field. It's fun driving it, though.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Has a little bouncy seat on it.
Phil Blydenberg is an assistant fire management officer with the Forestry Division's MATSU office. This day, he's acting as the incident command for the academy.
Each one of these vehicles are fully loaded with water and all the initial attack gear, the hose, the fittings. They're up to the weight that they're going to be operating at. And then, so each one of these courses is designed to get used to the engines and how they feel. And then more specifically, we're targeting getting them used to the blind spots, where those blind spots are on the vehicles.
It's the second day of the trials, and so far only one cone is on its side. Blydenberg says other than making sure firefighters are adept at driving, there are several reasons why the training session is so important. For those firefighters aspiring for promotion, it's a must to pass the course. And he says the Type 4 trucks are very expensive.
Close to $300,000.
Wow.
The smaller ones are in between $120,000 and $150,000.
So firefighters had better know how to run them and how to maintain them. The Type 4 truck carries 800 gallons of water. The smaller Type 6 carries 300 gallons. The trucks fit a national standard so that an incident commander can assess a situation, call for a Type 6, and get started on an initial attack. Trainees also must complete trials in pumping water in the field from the truck into a folding water tank and then into a hose. Tom Greeling, a state forestry official, says even this early in the season, 12 fires have erupted in the MATSU.
Seven of those fires are escape fires from open burning debris and burn barrel issues.
Greeling says there's no way to predict how severe the upcoming fire season will be, but it is possible to educate Alaskans on how to properly dispose of trash in a burn barrel and how to take precautions when burning debris. He says a burn permit is the first step. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska Brewing Company is entering the growing canned microbrew market. Starting today, the Juneau-based beer maker will sell its flagship Amber Ale and its Free Ride American Pale Ale in 12-ounce cans. In recent years, consumers have become more accepting of craft beer in cans. But is it as good as bottles? KTOO's Casey Kelly put it to the test.
Is there a difference in quality between Alaskan Brewing Company beer in cans or bottles? I set out to answer that question on a recent sunny afternoon. I grabbed a six-pack of Free Ride APA bottles and a can of the same beer supplied by the brewery and got together with a few friends for some grilled halibut and a side-by-side taste test. Before we started, there were a lot of theories about the differences between bottles and cans. My girlfriend, Kate, thought there might be a change in the level of carbonation.
I bet it'll be smaller bubble carbonation out of the can.
Our friend Quinn thought the can itself might affect the taste of the beer.
I'm wondering if there will be a distinctive tinny flavor.
Ultimately, we decided there wasn't much difference. None of us are beer snobs, and to our untrained palates, the stuff from the can tasted a lot like the stuff from the bottle. In light of that, Quinn brought up the next logical question, at least to our group of friends.
If you were to hike to a cabin, would you grab a six-pack of cans or a six-pack of bottles?
Cans.
Yep, cans.
Actually, I'd get two.
Alaskan Brewing Company co-founder Jeff Larson is banking on a lot of beer drinkers being into cans. They're lighter and more portable than glass, especially when empty, making them great for outdoor activities. Larson says the company had numerous requests for cans and wants to provide its beer in places where customers want to drink it.
Backpacking, boating, fishing, being on the beach.
But Larson says Alaskan isn't willing to sacrifice quality for convenience. While some small breweries, like Colorado-based Oscar Blues, have had success with canned beer for more than a decade, Alaskan took its time getting into the market. Larson says the company researched several canning lines before finding the right one at a brewing festival in Germany. The line reduces the amount of oxygen picked up during the canning process.
That's the key. Anytime you're dealing with filling bottles of beer or cans or kegs, it's exposure to air, exposure to oxygen that can lower the life. And this canning line is right now packaging the cans at the same quality as our bottling line.
He says the biggest difference between cans and bottles is that you're drinking from a different vessel.
Just the way the beer comes out of the can. It comes out in these little gurgles, and in that way, you're actually getting a different kind of experience. But as far as the quality of the beer, it's spot on.
The Alaskan Brewing Company plant is a maze of staircases and narrow walkways. As the company has grown over nearly 30 years, the footprint of its operation has stayed relatively small, even for a craft brewer. Larson and I are standing on a platform above the new canning line, which is wedged in near the bottling line and a packaging area in the main brew house.
When we made the commitment to go ahead and put the line in, we knew exactly what size we had, and it had to fit only in here. And it looks like it fits perfectly, but it took a little bit of effort.
Initially, the cans will be available only in Alaska because the company doesn't have enough space to produce canned beer for its markets in the lower 48. The brewery recently broke ground on a multi-million dollar expansion that will link its two buildings in Juneau's Lemon Creek area. The larger facility will allow the cans to be more widely distributed. While it's too soon to say what new beers Alaskan might produce, Larson says the expansion will let the company grow comfortably over the next decade.
You can't really know what's going to happen 12 months down the road. But now I think we're looking at 5 to 10 years with a lot more certainty and clarity.
The expansion project is scheduled to be complete by early next year. In addition to the new canning line, Alaskan recently started distributing its beers in two new states, Michigan and South Dakota. Alaskan Brewing Company beer is now available in 17 states nationwide. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Charles Enoch and Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Gokey. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dynina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.